WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author and teacher Laura Williams McCaffrey. Laura Williams McCaffrey's short stories have been published by Cicada, YA Review Network, Solstice Literary Magazine, and Soundings Review. Her story, Into the Vast, was awarded the 2014 SCBWI Magazine Merit Award for Fiction, while 20's Ruin received a letter of merit for SCBWI's 2015 Magazine Merit Competition. The first part of her novel in progress, 265 Days of Fury, was a finalist for the 2015 Katherine Patterson Prize for YA and Children's Writing, sponsored by Hunger Mountain, the VCFA Journal of the Arts. In February 2016, Clarion Books released Marked, a dystopian mixed-media fantasy for teens, which Kirkus Books called an original, textured page-turner. Laura Williams McCaffrey is the author of two children's fantasy novels, Water Shaper, selected in 2007 for the New York Public Library Books for the Teen Age list, and Aaliyah Waking, an IRA notable book and Teen's Top 10 Books nominee. Aaliyah Waking was also a nominee for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. Laura teaches at Solstice, the low residency MFA program at Pine Manor College, as well as Potsham School, an independent school for middle and high school students that offers classes to homeschoolers. She regularly mentors young writers at local public schools. I'll tell you a little bit about Marked, a little background. 16-year-old Lila lives in a bleak, controlling society where only the brightest and most favored students succeed. When she is caught buying cheats in an underground shadow market, she is tattooed, marked as a criminal. Then she is offered redemption and she jumps at the chance, but it comes at a cost. Doing what is right means betraying the boy she has come to love and perhaps losing even more than she thought possible. Graphic novel style vignettes revealing the history of this world provide Lila with guidance and clues to a possible way out of the double bind she finds herself in. When I spoke with Laura Williams McCaffrey, we did speak about her new novel, Marked, and I began by asking her to read from the book.
Chapter 1. Lila's eyes opened. Darkness. Cold. The walls too close, the ceiling too low, crept toward her. The room isn't squeezing shut. But she saw the walls press toward her and the ceiling sink. They closed her into a small, tight, airless cell and then kept pressing in on her. She gripped the thin blanket, no protection at all. Listen. She always forgot to listen. Coming through the dark was the sound of slow, deep breaths drawing in, drifting out. Hope slept nearby, calm and quiet. Lila shut her eyes and listened hard. Matching her breath to Hope's, she took air in. Then, breath matching breath, she pushed air out, in and out, with Hope. Their paired breath sounded like one breath, one person. The walls and ceiling lifted away. The second time Lila woke, she gave up on sleep. Trying not to think of her airless, shut-in-the-cell night terrors, she lit a candle stub and climbed to the top of the farmhouse, into the small, warm room she and Hope called the airy. She sat, careful not to let her feet brush over the piano keyboard painted on the floor near one wall. When Hope played the painted keys, she tilted her head as if she truly heard notes, and Lila couldn't help treating the keys as though sound could rise from them. The night terrors had started 2 weeks ago, not so long after Teacher Slate had invited her into her secondary school's advanced studies room, which kids mostly called the Bright. She'd finally earned scores good enough to win a seat in the Bright, yet primary alchemics was far more confusing than she thought it was going to be. It was like a strange language, but also like a strange mathic, a blend of numbers, symbols, letters, and words that you use to form equations. And she wasn't any good at learning them. But no primary alchemics, no patron, no patron, no university. She'd be stuck grubbing for credit points the rest of her life. She wasn't going to let that happen.
Thank you very much for reading that. That was Laura Williams McCaffrey reading from Marked, which is published by Clarion Books. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if we could start with you talking a little bit about writing this book. It's a dystopian novel, fantasy. And I wonder if you can talk about having to quickly establish a world right from the start that a reader can understand, settle into, and feel comfortable enough to then follow the plot.
That is definitely a tricky thing. And I think in the past with my novels, I tended to explain a little more. Mm-hmm. And I tried with this one to make more clearer through function, essentially,
right,
like how things played out in the world, and to keep some of the made-up words close enough that you could at least make guesses as to what they were going to be, and keep the focus really on their role in the character's life and their importance in the character's lives. But it is a tricky balance, and some readers want more explanation than others. And so I just find myself as a reader wanting less and less of that explanation and more of it to kind of unfold with the story.
Yeah. I think sometimes as a reader, I just want to be trusted to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And because over-explanation will bother me more than being sort of trusted to get there on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about the vocabulary? You mentioned that just very briefly, that you try to make some of the words similar to words that we're already familiar with. Some of the vocabulary in Marked includes barons, blue coats, red fist, squatties. There's also the gray cloaks.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so is that fun coming up with those words?
It is fun. As you were reading that, I was realizing like how color focused
it
is, which was more a function of me thinking about how names come about, because a lot of those are kind of nicknames. They're slang names.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about how we name things and what we kind of pick to represent something, I guess.
Yeah.
And squatties is, you know, very much about function. Like, this, they squat. This
yeah.
is what they do.
Right.
People call them squatties.
Right. So how much do you know about your plot? Not so much, I'm not talking about the fantasy world anymore, but the plot itself. Mm-hmm. How much do you know as you begin?
That's a good question, especially with this one. I rewrote this book at a certain point, like started from the beginning, and the plot changed quite a bit. When I begin, I do not know a ton about the plot. I know what the problem or the goal is from the start, like what the situation is for the character. I know what that character's desire is, and what stands in the way of her, you know, fulfilling that desire. And then I tend to know what the other characters, how they relate to the desire, essentially, or the obstacle. And I tend to have an idea of where the story is going to end up, but I am often wrong about that.
Is that right?
Yes.
Interesting.
Until I kind of get closer, and then I realize, oh, this is the thing that happens. But I'm not a plotter, like an outline-y kind of planner person,
right,
with novels anyway.
Does that mean it takes a while to write a novel?
Yeah, I'm a messy writer, and I throw out a lot, like hundreds of pages.
Wow.
I throw out a lot of it.
Now, you said this one changed a lot after you had started it. Had you already written a full first draft?
I had already written like a very much revised draft. And in fact, I had given it to my editor and we had worked on it for a while. And there was an aspect of it that wasn't coming together. And I kind of set it aside and started from the beginning knowing that it was... Well, once I got into that beginning and I kind of wrote and I thought, oh, my goodness, like this is kind of cool. I realized that if she liked it, I would have to rewrite the entire novel.
Which is less cool, suddenly.
Which is less cool. And it does really take me a couple of years to get a book written, but so it seemed crazy. It seemed like a crazy thing to do, a crazy person thing to do, like someone who just is not realistic about themselves. I should be more precise in my language there. and I did it anyway.
And you did it, and she.
She loved it.
Loved it. So that makes sense. That mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can sink far more than 2 years in the wrong novel.
Well, right. So, that's true.
By trying not to get to the right novel.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so we've already started to talk about my next question a little bit. I was just going to ask what your revision process is like. So is there anything else that you would expand on there?
Yeah. I mean, that's a rewrite. So that to me is a little bit different because you're really starting from the beginning
right.
with the blank page and re.
That what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. A revision to me, like, so if I get feedback from an editor or from a reader, then I reread and I, with like kind of my editorial hat on, and start marking things up before I dive back in. And so I might be thinking about, like, do I need to take out these scenes? Are there scenes that are missing to create the story that I want to create? Are there characters who seem strong at certain parts in the story but are not in other parts of the story? So I'm taking like a lot of notes mm-hmm. and thinking about pacing and all those things too. And some of that has to do with those explanations. Like, are there too many explanations just bogging everything down?
Right, right, right.
And then when I dive back in, it can be very intimidating because I have all these notes and I have all my stickies and I have everything like worked on. And then I'm going through and the scenes that need rewriting or need more work, I'm getting to as I go along. So if there's like page one only needs small changes, I make those small changes and then kind of keep going
right.
bit by bit that way.
Okay. I want to talk a little more generally about writing for young adults.
Mm-hmm.
Do you try to access sort of your own younger self as you write? Do you do anything to get into a certain head to be writing for that audience?
Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, I mean not that I do things to get into that place, but I still feel like I have access to that place in the sense of what I cared about at that age
mm-hmm.
In regard to stories, but also just like the things that preoccupied me. I still do work with kids too, and that can be reassuring because people talk a lot about things have changed and social media and blah, blah, blah. And that's true. Their lives are very different from being a teenager in the 80s. But their preoccupations are the same.
Right.
And their feelings are the same.
They just have different vehicles.
Yeah, they have different vehicles.
Which, frankly, I'm glad we didn't have. That seems like it would be so much harder to live now.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I hear, you know, the horror stories about being preoccupied with how many likes you get
mm-hmm.
From friends in your high school, and that's a really different thing. Yeah.
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 How do you access your narrator? And if you want to talk about this narrator, whose name is Lila, that's fine, or if there's a more general answer that mm-hmm. would make sense.
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's based on desire, really. Like, it's based on what her, and that's pretty much at this point always been her, what her desire is and how she thinks she's going to try and get that. There is also sometimes a tone to the voice that depends on the story and the character.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sometimes why I don't write more than one novel at once, because they creep into each other doesn't end up distinct enough. But when I started writing short stories, I became more aware of how crucial that tone was and the sound of it, I guess, the sound of the tone.
Yeah. Will you read out loud as you're trying to develop a narrator's voice?
I don't. I hear in my head, which is why I don't listen to music or anything mm-hmm. while I write, because I can hear the sound of what it is.
Yeah.
Once I have a draft, sometimes I will read out loud to myself so that then I notice things that I don't always notice. But Yeah, I hear the writing for me all has an auditory component. Like I can hear the words. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm. So I definitely sensed themes in this book that could be seen as carrying messages for young readers, or not a moral, but just sort of ideas that will help them. And I wonder if you can talk about addressing your young adult audience without talking down to them, sort of letting your work carry a message that doesn't feel preachy, which this doesn't, but I think you do it well because they're both things there. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that has to do with character development and complicated characters, because what ends up feeling preachy is when the characters are too simple and everybody falls into their slots, like kind of a stereotypical slot. And there's nothing likable about the unlikable characters. And there are no flaws in the likable characters. And so that's what I think the way around that is, to try and think about them as in the way that we think about the people in our lives that have a balance of lots of different kinds of things.
Right. Everything's not black and white.
Yeah, no. And that you have hard choices to make.
Marked stays with our narrator, Lila. And I know in the past you've been known to write from multiple points of view. What was it like staying with one point of view this time? I'm trying to remember, your first book was one point of view as well, right? So which, do you have a preference?
Not really. I mean, to me, the other points of view in here are the illustrated points of view in a way. And so those form their own complication in the story.
Yeah.
Let me think about this. Like, I've never written an omniscient narration where you've got a bigger field. I don't know that I would be able to do that, actually.
Because you like access to a narrator's point of view or thought process?
Yeah, I don't think I have the chops right now. I don't know that I could do it without it ending up seeming like I was kind of all over the place.
Right. I think it's a delicate balance, isn't it? To be able to be omniscient, it does allow you into everybody's consciousness in a way.
Right.
But if you do it wrong, it just feels like you've made mistakes.
Right. Like it's like the bad camera of people's home videos that are swinging all over the place. Like that's what I fear.
Right.
So I do tend to stay close to whatever the narrator is. I do tend to stay with them.
So you just mentioned the graphic novel component in this book. It's called Threatened Alchemics, and I enjoyed this very much. It sort of takes on a larger role than just Lila reading her comic book or her graphic novel. I don't want to give too much away, but I want to talk how this idea came about, that there was a graphic novel built into the book and also a story within a story.
Yeah, I had never written anything that had a more contemporary or modern feel. And so when I was writing this, I was thinking about what their pop culture would be, like what would they be into. And at the same time, I was reading The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, which is all about comics. And I had never really been a comics reader, but because of that, essentially there's been a boom in teen and children's writing. I was starting to read more and more of them. And in that novel, he does have some of the comics that the creators create, and they're written in prose. And originally, I had written the comic sections in prose. But when I sent the novel in, I asked if what would you think if these were illustrated? And they liked that idea a lot. It posed a book design challenge. There was a lot of back and forth because of things that the reader had to see at certain points for the prose part response to make sense.
Yeah.
So that was really different. I never had those challenges before.
Right.
But that's how it came about. And then she was into them. And then I started to realize that they could also kind of serve this role in the story around, because they're kind of the mythic history of where she comes from. Mm-hmm. And so they could provide another layer in a way of the world and what it was about. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I also had access to her identification with the characters, and the other character, Gil, feels mm-hmm. the same way, and the way they kind of take on those roles as part of their relationship. And that was really nice to be able to use, yeah. too. That was fun.
Yeah, it is. It's really fun. And I'm wondering just the illustrations, were they done by the same person who designed the cover, or was that a different...
That's different. So the illustrator is Sally Cantorino, and she is someone who did a wonderful job. And she was someone I kind of found through a friend of a friend, and I suggested her. I saw her work and suggested her. I didn't really know her. And at the time when they were looking at illustrators' work, the thing about the children's and young adult world is that the illustrator and the author don't tend to have mm-hmm. a lot of communication.
Right.
So, you know, I just handed them the scripts, and then the book design person worked with her to make it all work. And the cover, again, was the book design person at Clarion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, since we're talking about it, I love the cover. It's the picture of a woman's or a young woman's hand, and her wrist is exposed, and it's tattooed with the word marked, which is great. But I loved the nail polish.
That is my favorite part.
That is my favorite part. So the nail polish is kind of worn away. She's really, really, it's been a long time since that manicure.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. It tells you a lot about the hand that you're looking at.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of the cover.
So good.
A lot of people have responded to it. I always feel a little odd about actual people on the cover of fantasy novels, because all of a sudden it puts us in kind of our own culture, our own racial expectations, all mm-hmm. of these things in a way that is kind of difficult. But I love that hand, and I love the chipped nail polish. It's my favorite part
yeah,
of the cover.
It's great. So now Lila and her sister Hope have a very close relationship from the start of the novel. And although, as you say, there's no black, there's no white. But at the beginning, you know, we see Hope as this very good girl. She's a good student. She doesn't break the rules. She can't imagine ever getting into trouble. And this sets up a nice set of divided loyalties for Lila, who does inadvertently get into trouble and gets sort of taken down this whole unexpected path. And so, you know, she has to agree to work with various groups. Plus, she has a lot of loyalty toward her sister and her family. Mm-hmm. And then she has this old childhood friend that I have another question about in a minute. But I wonder if you can talk about these divided loyalties and why they make for a more interesting storyline, which to me, this was key to mm-hmm. why this book works so well.
Well, because she's placed in a double bind, and mm-hmm. I realized, I keep saying this to people, that is like an incredible tension engine for a novel, the double bind. And I think, too, in some ways, it's the way you feel as a teenager, even when there isn't so much at stake. You feel loyal to your family, and your parents are telling you you need to do certain things, and you feel loyal to your friends, and your friends might have other things they think you should be doing.
Right.
And you're worried about your future, and you're trying to make choices to make yourself happy. You don't know yourself very well, and so that's kind of hard to puzzle through.
Right, and then there's the teacher, you know.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, we've all had a special teacher that we would really like to impress. You know,
right, yeah.
That's yet another one.
Yeah. And so in some ways in the novel, what occurs to me as I'm talking is that it's about figuring out what's right and wrong for you, even when there are people that you love who you're not sure whether if you do the things that are going to please them are going to be the right things or the wrong things.
Right. Yeah.
And that puts her in a tricky situation. But I also think a lot of teens feel that way about a lot of aspects of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting because young adult is an age where all of a sudden you start to recognize that adults are not perfect. They do not have all the answers. They do not understand what's going to happen based on this series of events that they're telling you is the right thing to do.
You know?
So it's really, the other thing that I loved was that Gil is this friend from her childhood, right? Mm-hmm. So they were very little when they formed a friendship. And then they find themselves in the middle of this exploding rebellion, which is a very adult reality. And these two things come together to put a smack in the middle of what the YA genre is all about, you know? It's like these readers are pulled into the two worlds that they are presently in between.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and a lot of the, I mean, Lila has a very strong family, but a lot of the, and Hope, but a lot of the characters, the kids, don't, or they've stepped out of their family for various reasons.
Right.
And so they're trying to be adults, even though they aren't yet.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, is the place a lot of kids feel they are. They're either because they want to be adults or because their family situations or the situations in their communities are such that they kind of have to try to be, even though they're not quite there yet. They're just starting out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. What do you do when you are writing, and we've already talked about how, you know, maybe an idea begins for you, and maybe you have some idea of where you're heading, but in the meantime, you have to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you don't know what's going to happen next? Do you have any anything that you do to help yourself figure it out?
That's a good question. I stare at a blank piece of paper for a long time. Well, I mean, sometimes that staring is about, so something just happened. And that something creates a result.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to figure out what the character's response to that result is. And I don't always know what that's going to be. So I do stare at the paper a lot. And sometimes I just kind of take these weird notes around, like, what everybody feels right now at this moment and what they might do because of those feelings to try to get a sense of where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean like the next moment, like, you know, 5 seconds later, but also thinking about what is the scene? What is the next scene? Like the next important thing that happens and how does everybody enter into that scene? And what are they feeling so that when they bump up against each other, something will happen, essentially.
Okay. I was curious if your daughters give you feedback on your work.
They don't when it's in progress.
So they don't see it until it's a novel that's got a cover and...
Well, they see it before that when it's a... They saw the arc. They saw, like, substantial drafts. Yeah, I mean, maybe when they're a little older, I would. It's funny, like, I have a hard time taking feedback in a way. Like, I kind of have to, like, withdraw and make sense of it. And I guess I didn't want to put the pressure on them or on me to bring that into our relationship.
That's true, too, because it puts pressure on you to do what they suggest.
Yeah.
And what if they suggest the wrong thing?
and pressure on them to, because I'm their mom and they don't want me to feel bad, but they want to be honest. Like, there are just complicated feelings there. And they were still pretty... I mean, they're just now, Carrie's about to turn 21, Maggie's about to turn 19, so they're now turning into grown-ups, but they were still kind of kids.
Right. Outside of your writing life, you teach at Solstice, Pine Manor College's low residency MFA in writing program, and you also teach literature and writing at Pacham School and Home School Center. And I know that you're trained as a librarian. Do you still work as a librarian?
I haven't for quite a while. I just have ended up doing a lot of teaching of writing.
Yeah, and you conduct workshops, you lead workshops, and you give talks, and So how does all of that feed itself? Like, do you find that you're a better writer for having done all this teaching? Do you feel like it feeds, or do you find that it makes it hard to find time to write because you've got these teaching responsibilities?
The answer to that is both.
Yeah.
I think I've become a vastly more thoughtful writer from teaching. Mm-hmm. I understand better from looking at people's work what – I don't want to say diagnosing like it's sick, but looking at what's not working in a scene or what is working well or what's not working in a story and what's working well and be able to articulate that and think about how it works mm-hmm. has made me a much more thoughtful writer. And I find it inspiring to work with students. I always find my students inspiring. I find my young students inspiring. I find my old students inspiring. I mean, I love their passion. I love their way. They're very brave. They lay their work out. I love that they get discouraged and try to find their way through it. I love all of that. It can be very time consuming and emotionally draining to do a lot of teaching, so there are times when I feel tired.
Right. Are any of these programs where you have a pretty strict grading system, or is it a little bit looser than that?
I do not have a strict grading system. They're all narrative assessment.
Okay.
And when I'm responding to people's work, I'm like writing on their pages and
sure.
giving them notes and we're talking it through. And
what are the ages in the different programs?
Mm-hmm. Well, the PACHM is 10 to 18.
Okay.
And this year, I do have a pretty wide spread of students. I have both kind of a high school class and more of a middle school class. And then Solstice is, you know, they're it's a low residency MFA, so they have students who are kind of all ages.
Right.
Grown up. Some of them are young. They seem young to me. You know, they're just out of college.
Right.
And some of them are much older.
Do you have different approaches with you must. But so let's say you have this 12-year-old who's mm-hmm. writing, and then you have this 40-year-old that's writing, mm-hmm. and within their own experiences and age groups, they are writing at a certain level. So, like, do you work really, really hard to protect the littler children from your, you know, maybe harsher assessments, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, so working with students, I often feel like part of that is feeling them out, like feeling mm-hmm. out what they're up for. The younger students, you know, some of them are working on academic writing, so I am trying to push them to learn how to write the way
right.
you would write for school. But still, with some of them, we get some kids who are anxious or who don't see themselves as writers. And so my goal for that kid and how I might help them is going to be really different from a kid who really sees him or herself as a writer, does a lot of writing, and is prolific and writes lots of drafts. The kinds of feedback I would give them would be very different.
Yeah.
The grown-ups are a little different because that's a master's level program. And many of them...
People can be very sensitive in that sort of setting, too.
They are. They can be. That's very true. But many of them also aspire to be professionals, professional writers, or to work in some kind of professional capacity with writing. And I do try to be very supportive, but also honest about, you know, this is what it's about. Like,
right.
if you're going to be a professional writer, you really have to be up for this.
Right.
You have to be up for me writing all over your pages and getting really long letters for feedback. And also, you know, try to be upfront about, you know, I am one reader. You're going to have lots of other readers. They might have different responses to you. You're going to leave this program. You're going to find the readers that you think are going to best help you go forward as a writer. And they might think very differently
mm-hmm.
from me. So you're going to take what you can get from me and go on in your life.
Right.
But I'm not going to ask any more from you than I have had to ever do myself. So that's where it stands.
Absolutely. Do you find that there's pressure from a program? I'm not mm-hmm. saying necessarily Solstice, but like mm-hmm. in the MFA community, is there the reputation that these programs put pressure on their faculty members to publish regularly? And
oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, my program is very supportive of its faculty.
Mm-hmm.
That's my finding. Of course, the program, you know, what draws people to programs is to have well-published writers. But I don't feel like a specific pressure from them to turn out books and get them out or anything of that kind. Not there.
Okay. What are you reading these days that you might recommend?
I'm reading Bone Gap by Laura Ruby, which won the Prince this year, and I'm really liking that. One of my favorite books that I read last year, or might have been earlier this year, but I think it was last year, is This One Summer by Mariko Tamaki and Jillian Tamaki.
Do you have a new writing project started yet?
I do. I've been working on this project for a while. It is a fantastical mystery, and it is told in three separate mysteries. So the third one relates to the detective herself. I've been having a lot of trouble with the third one. The first and second one were very easy. The third one has been hard to get into.
Wait, now say this again.
The third part. So basically, the main character is kind of a detective, and she solves one mystery about another character and another mystery about another character. And then the third one, there are clues in the other two that lead to this third one. And that one is more about herself.
Oh.
But I'm having a lot of trouble with that one.
maybe it's about yourself.
I know. Probably true. And then I have a lot of other stuff that's in various states of disarray. And a short story that's coming out March. And so a lot that's all in pieces.
Where will the story be?
It's called YA Review Network. So it'll be online.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Lila's and Hope's parents work in a mine. And I wondered if you did a lot of research into mining before you wrote Marked, or any other research that you could talk about conducting for this book. But also, as a writer who has worked as a librarian, I wondered if you could offer advice for readers who have to do research.
Yes. Well, it's funny because I thought the mine would play a much bigger role in this story than it did. And it was part of what started me on it. There's this picture of one of those mines. I've forgotten where it is now. It might be in Russia. That is, you know, so humongous you can see it from the air. And that was part of the start of this story. I certainly did read early on about mining communities and think a lot about class dynamics and how things play out when you have a large class divide, essentially. And some of that has to do with thinking about how our country seems to be heading in that direction.
Yeah.
And going to school for kids, as I am painfully aware, becomes harder and harder the more economically it is out of your reach. And so thinking about how people are like on Kickstarter trying to raise money for their college tuition, and suddenly like finding a patron to send you to college does not seem actually that far away.
Right, which is part of the plot line of Mark.
Yes, which is part of the plot line. So I do that kind of research. Some of it is not hard research. Some of it is more reading to get a sense of how the world works, or how it has worked historically, or how it has worked in various cultures at various times, to think about how situations play out under certain circumstances. You know, if I were writing a historical novel, I would do a lot more hard research where I was taking notes and like thinking about dates and those kinds of details. But a lot of times what I'm thinking about is more the, I don't want to say the feel, that seems really mushy, but like it's almost like human nature and social systems and how those work. And so I studied history as an undergrad and I still read a lot of history. And so that's the kind of research that I often end up doing, how societies work.
Yeah.
And then kind of levels of technology, like what you might have at certain times in some areas that you might not have in others, those kinds of things.
Right.
I once, with my first novel, someone said, oh, there are buttons. Did people used to have buttons? And I was like, yes, people have had buttons for a really long time. It's like, yes. So people who are doing research, well, I mean, the library is your best friend, and do not stop at your, you know, the first two spots on your Google search and just use those for resources.
Right.
But one of the things that is great right now is that there are so many primary documents online, so many things, so that you can read people's stories, you can read primary accounts of events. And whether you're going for hard research or more of a feel of a certain time, you just have a wealth of material to have access to that, you know, 20 years ago, you would have had to gone to some library in a big city and dug through boxes to find.
That, I remember that subject index. Do you remember what is that called? I forget, but there was like a subject index and you would look
Library up. Library of Congress with a Dewey Decimal subject index,
That was where we always started. That was the far cry from Google.
I mean, you can look at, there is so many
Would you say Google is sort of a first stop for figuring out where you're going?
I think it can be, sure. But just, you know, don't click on somebody's random blog post and say, I've done my research.
Right. Now I know all about it.
there are many great things out there. Museums now often have digitized images of their collections. You can look at bowls and cups and the kinds of daily life things that you find in fiction that's not so much the, you know, the date that someone did a specific, you know, battle and won. It's more like the way people lived.
Right.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah. All right. I want to repeat the name of the book again. It's Marked, Laura Williams McCaffrey, and the publisher is Clarion Books. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with Laura Williams McCaffrey, whose new novel is Marked, published by Clarion. And you can learn more about Laura Williams McCaffrey and her work at her website, laurawilliamsmccaffrey.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to expand the vocabulary of a world about which you are writing. So in Marked, there were cheats. She buys cheats in an underground shadow market. That's part of the vocabulary of the novel Marked. Laura Williams McCaffrey says in our interview that the fantastical vocabulary of the dystopian world of her novel Marked tends to be functional vocabulary. I like that word, cheats. Squatties squat. That's what they do, she tells us. So in considering the world that you are perhaps creating in a piece of fiction or even poetry or an essay, even if you're not working on a dystopian piece, think about the functional vocabulary of that place, time, or community. Are you writing about a faraway place? Maybe there's a vocabulary that you could research and expand on. Is there a vocabulary that you should perhaps invent? Is there a workplace in your piece that might have a specialized functional vocabulary? Perhaps you're writing about an ad agency that has a code word to refer to an important client who's waiting in the lobby. Or maybe your narrator's family has words or expressions that are specific to their experience that you could add to amplify your reader's understanding of their life together. So maybe the mother always shouts a certain phrase when she wants the kids to turn out their lights and go to sleep. Maybe she shouts bedtime at the top of her lungs, or does she come to the door and barely whisper it with a tone that's very threatening? So anyway, think about this. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. I'd like to encourage everyone who's listening to please get in touch and let us know what you think of the show. What do you like? What do you wish that we would do more of or less of? Are there certain authors who you'd love to see us interview? Certain books that you've heard of that are coming out, either Vermont books or non-Vermont books, although we do kind of try to include a lot of Vermont selections. Let us know what you think. writethebook@gmail.com is the way to get in touch. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. Also by Advance Music, a full-line music shop offering instruments and gear, audio-video design and installation, and electronic and stringed instrument repair services. You're local, we're local. Advance, it's been all about the music for more than 30 years. Located at 75 Maple Street in Burlington and online at advancemusicvt.com. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily retail space, sorry, daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information or come down to the Burlington waterfront. And finally, by the Vermont Developmental Disabilities Council, a board led by individuals and family members that focuses on bringing Vermonters with developmental disabilities into the heart of our communities. For more information about the council and becoming a member, visit ddc.vermont.gov or call 888-317-2006. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And my co-host, Gary Lee Miller, has a website as well, and that is GaryLeeMiller.com. As I already said, if you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, news about book-related events, you just want to let us know how you think we're doing, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And also, if you go on iTunes, you can rate us. Say on iTunes what you think, maybe write a review or just rate us using their star rating. That would always be great. We really appreciate any ratings. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And finally, once again, this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. Have a great day.